Today is February the 20th, 2018. And this is an interview between Gerard Fawcett and Vic Schoenbeck.
Great. All right. So, Vic, I hope everything's going well with you. Thanks again for sitting down with us to have sort of a second part follow-up to our previous interview. So today I'm going to continue to ask you a few more questions about your experiences at UNC and everything that you've kind of done with the Minority Health Project, and specifically the Minority Student Caucus and the Minority Health Conference today. So let's get started. Could you tell me about the Minority Health Project? Kind of why was it started and who helped start it?
Okay. So I was actually trying to type up some notes, and that reminded me that the background to these things, the Minority Student Caucus was founded in 1971, back in the early 70s, and it was pushing for more minority health research, minority health-related activities. And they started the conference in 1977, and that was also for the same purpose and to increase the emphasis, to put more attention on these issues because there were major health disparities. And then this was not an outgrowth of that, but I think Bill Jenkins may have had some involvement. I don't know if you're familiar with the report of the Secretary's Task Force on Black and Minority Health. Mm-hmm. It's a major federal report, multi-volumes. I've got a copy of it sitting down there on the left. You see those gray volumes with kind of purple titles on the bottom shelf? Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of them. So that was a major report that came out during the Reagan administration. Margaret Heckler was the Secretary of Health and Human Services. I don't know how much personal involvement she had in it, but she did issue the report. And it was a pretty impressive undertaking where they went through a number of major health areas, I think cardiovascular disease and cancer and several others, and they published this report about health disparities, which had been raised before, and there had been a report on cancer before that, I think, that Jerome Wilson had, there was some conference that he attended and talked to me about. But this really put health disparities on the map, or it certainly helped to put it on the map, because here was a major federal report that was outlining, listing all these health disparities, and of course they said there's not enough data, but the data that there are indicate substantial disparities, and not just for African Americans, but they said there's really very little data on groups other than African Americans. So that was a part of the substantial increase in interest in data on minority health in the mid-1980s. So that interest was mounting, and it was reflected partly in grant funding available from the NIH and other federal agencies. So there was an opportunity for smoking cessation research funds from the National Cancer Institute. They had an RFA specifically for African Americans, or smoking cessation and prevention for African Americans, and smoking cessation and prevention for Latinos, I think. Hispanics, I guess, was the word they used. But and that was in the mid-1980s, and I was involved with several people in getting a grant proposal together to do a smoking cessation study in collaboration with the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. So that began, I think, in 1985, and that was going on for several years. Other projects were started. And then later in the 1980s, the National Cancer Institute came out with a solicitation, an RFA or something, for a cooperative agreement for cancer centers to create minority cancer control research activities. So I worked with the Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. I'm not sure they were comprehensive at the time, but I worked with the cancer center to write, it was for a supplement to the Cancer Center Core Grant for minority cancer control research, and we had several projects. One involved mammography promotion or expansion. Another was smoking cessation kind of a continuation of the work we were doing with North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. Sandra Hedden was involved in that. Another was prostate cancer, and Paul Godley did his dissertation with funds from that. That his dissertation involved prostate cancer etiology. I think there may have been another one, but I can't remember it. So that was going on in the beginning of the 1990s. And then the National Cancer Institute, National Center for Health Statistics, which doesn't usually do extramural grants, but they got some funding and came out with an RFA for projects to improve minority health statistics, because the major report had said, there's really a shortage of data, and there certainly could be improvements in statistics, minority health statistics. So three of my colleagues, and although I've become identified with this project, I was actually not there in the beginning nor in the early years. Three of my colleagues, Dorothy Brown, whom I'll refer to probably as Dot Brown, Trudy Bennett, both of them were faculty in the Department of Maternal and Child Health, and Lloyd Edwards, who was a faculty member in the Department of Biostatistics, worked together to develop a grant proposal to NCHS, National Center for Health Statistics, for a minority health project. And there were, as I recall, three aims in the original proposal, which would have been submitted in about 1994, something like that. One of the things was that there wasn't a good way to learn about how to do minority health research. So they proposed to develop a short course, like an institute, on conducting minority health research. The second leg or aim, I guess, was a literature database, because in that era, I mean, it was the early years of Medline, so you could start to do research. I forget, there was a predecessor to Medline. I forget what that was. That was out there, and then there was Medline. And so you could arrange to do a literature search, and you could do it on minority health. But actually, it was limited in terms of who could get access to it. For a while, you had to go to the library, and then you could do it maybe from elsewhere if you were a UNC person. But if you weren't connected to a major research university, you didn't get access. And then also, there was some data around, but not a whole lot, and you couldn't really find it. So the second aim was to develop a literature database that could be searched, keyword searchable, maybe subject term searchable. The third aim was a database of databases, so that you could actually find out if there was data on a topic that you might be interested in. Let me turn down the bell on this a little bit. So those were the three aims, and they did get funding. Lloyd Edwards was the principal investigator, and they began with they began by starting to work on these databases, and then to develop the short course, Trudy Bennett, Dorothy Brown, and I think Lloyd Edwards, I think the three of them went to the University of Michigan summer program. For many years, they'd had a summer program, several weeks, and the three of them went to there and delivered a version of this course. They essentially developed a version of the course that they presented over probably a week in Michigan. You wanted to know who started it, so I've told you that. You wanted to know why it was started. I think I've told you that.
Mm-hmm. I guess the next follow-up was what were its major outcomes and efforts?
Okay. Well, I mentioned the three aims. The literature database, I'll say first, that one was developed, and it became available, and people were submitting queries, and it was nationally available. I don't know as much about it because I still wasn't involved really in the project. But of course, at a certain point, Medline became increasingly available and was no longer restricted to major universities. So, in a sense, the literature project was supplanted by Medline, which was great. They had gotten a few years at least for people before that, and then Medline was able to do it without the project being involved. The database of databases similarly was brought online. They had assembled, I can't remember, but a large collection of federal and state level and private we funded databases. I mean, like, these were research projects that people had collected survey data, other kinds of data, and through this project they were able to make it available. Again, that was before I got involved. I have a little bit of documentation about it. But they were able to make those data available. I don't know if they were able to keep track of who published what from it or anything like that. There are some reports, and they did publish at least one article about the Minority Health Project. And then, so this thing that I'm going to call the Institute, the course, was taught for the first time in Michigan, and then the next year, which I think would have been 1995, they presented a version of it here with guest presenters. And another thing that the project did, this is the really early years of the World Wide Web, and Lloyd, I think, was probably one of the key people here for the vision and maybe for the accomplishment as well. The project developed a website. So the Minority Health Project was one of the first parts of the university to have a website where you could go online and find out things about the project, and they made access to the literature database and to the database of databases was being made available through there, and they were writing their own, doing their own development, because this was before you could very easily use prepackaged things. They had a number of biostatistics students, I think, who were working for them doing coding and whatnot. So it was actually quite an impressive thing, and it was a nice looking. I mean, the website didn't look the way modern websites look. This was browsers. I mean, at the beginning, of course, the browsers did only text. They didn't have graphics, so the web looked very different. But it was still functional, and they could get a lot of information around that way. So I got involved in 1997, I think it was. One of my colleagues had been working with them. I'm blocking on her name, and I feel terrible about that because she's a wonderful person. And I knew her well, but I haven't thought about her in a while, I guess, and so I lost her name, but I can get it back. Rachel Royce. Rachel Royce was an advanced epidemiologic methods instructor, and she'd been working with them, but then she left UNC to go to RTI, I think. And so Lloyd asked me if I would get involved, so I was happy to join. So I got involved and would come to the meetings, and I think I got involved shortly before I had gone to the institutes that they held, and they had about, I don't know, 70 people in the Michelle Ibrahim seminar room, 1301 McGavin Greenberg. I went to the one there. I think that was the first one, might have been the second one. I went to parts of the first and the second. And these were very good institutes. They had leading researchers from around the country would come. I have the lists on the web. So I have information about every one of these annual institutes on the website, including the speakers, the agenda, and things like that. So I came on in about 1997, and that was the year that someone had found some money at the federal level to pay for a company that did satellite broadcasting from HBCUs. It was something called the HBCU Satellite Network, something like that. And it was run by O.J. McGee's mother-in-law. So in 1997, in the summer, someone had gotten this money for them to come down here and satellite broadcast the afternoon sessions of this institute. The institute at the time was 5 full days, Monday through Friday, all day, and they had a Sunday activity as well, but it's basically Monday through Friday. And so the idea was that the afternoon sessions would be broadcast around the world, around, you know, anywhere. It was probably Ku-band satellite, I think. So that was quite an experience, because no one had ever done this from the school, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody else had done this from the university. And whereas they'd had about 70 people in these institutes they'd done in the school, all of a sudden we had 300 people for the afternoon, because there were people at this was not something anybody could tune into. You needed a Ku-band receiver and that sort of stuff. But I forget, the list of sites is probably on the web. They had, you know, a number of other universities and so on. And that they were paying several hundred dollars, as I recall, to do this. And, of course, we were paying for the satellite, but there was money for that. Oh, the dean's office provided money for the satellite and other things. Lloyd was a good negotiator, and the dean's office was very generous. So that really transformed the vision of what this could be. So the following year, so Lloyd Edwards, he said, you know, this is the way we're going to go. So the following year, the broadcast was done from the Rosenau Auditorium, which was hardly a suitable place, but nevertheless, O.J. McGee managed to set it up that way, and the people he was working with, obviously. They had a satellite truck parked in I don't know what you call it, you know, if you come in on Dower Drive. This was before the Hooker Building existed. So there was space there, there was a big parking lot, and they drove this truck in, and it was sitting up right next to Rosenau Auditorium, where the cable's going out, and that's where the broadcast took place from. So that was 97. So in 98, by then, the school had something called the Mays Center, the Mays Telecommunications Center, which then disappeared and then came back. And so Lloyd decided to move the activity to the Mays Center. I may have a picture of it here. No, this is from the era, but this doesn't show the Mays Center. But we have pictures of it. It was like a classroom, essentially. So the institute was held there, which meant the institute was a lot smaller because that couldn't hold 60 people. That could hold maybe 30 people or something like that. But the afternoon sessions were broadcast on KU band, and that reached, I think we reached maybe 600 people that year or something like that. So then Lloyd Edwards got recruited to Duke University, and the question was, well, who's going to lead the Minority Health Project? So Lloyd asked if I would do it, and I said, well, you know, maybe we can find somebody else. So they looked around. There were some people, I think, who came and visited, but in the end, there was nobody else, and I ended up inheriting it. So Lloyd was a Duke. Dot Brown was, did I mention that she and I had been doing a research project in Durham with four middle schools?
Mm-mm.
So it was probably about the time that the Minority Health Project was getting started. Dot Brown and I had written a grant proposal. As I mentioned, the federal government was trying to get more data for minority health, and there was a major RFA for adolescent health, violence prevention, sexual behavior, and substance use. And Dot Brown had built a collaboration involving some researchers at Duke University and some people from the community, the Durham community. Four schools were involved. She put this project together called Project RAP, for Reaching Adolescents, Parents, and Peers. And that was a major intervention study that she was leading. And it began, I think, a bit before the Minority Health Project started. I don't remember the exact years. But anyway, it was underway. And by then, she was very heavily pulled into it, so that she had kind of withdrawn from the Minority Health Project. So that when Lloyd left, it was only Trudy, and Trudy wasn't interested in trying to lead it. So I was asked to do it, and that's when I became involved. In 98, essentially, I became the de facto director. So, and at the time, it had a fair amount of money, because it was getting this grant from the National Center for Health Statistics, which I think had been renewed at least once. But I was taking it over with one more year of funding, and the funding did run out, and we were able to get some additional funding at a much lower level through, there was some money that was unspent that we could spend out, and then there was another project that came into the school that I think involved a statistics emphasis, and maybe Bill Kalsbeek may have been the principal investigator, and we had a little piece of it. So there were these three projects in the school: the Minority Health Project, which was the newest of them, I guess, Project RAP, which was the second newest, and then the oldest was the North Carolina Mutual Quit for Life study, which was the smoking cessation study. And at the same time, or along as these things were being developed, there was also a movement to try to get a research center, a minority health research center, or a minority health research and education center in the School of Public Health, to really make this something that we could get more mileage out of what was going on. Because a lot of people were working on minority health, but it was fairly uncoordinated, you know, everybody doing his own thing and so on. So, did I mention Minority Cancer Control Research Program? I think I did, yeah, okay. So, the university undertook a strategic planning effort in the early 1990s, maybe the end of the 1980s, and the School of Public Health was actually a little bit in advance of that. So Michelle Ibrahim was leading this strategic planning effort for the school, and through the series of meetings and discussions and retreats and whatnot, six goals emerged. And Dot Brown and I and others were pushing for a goal on minority health. And so goal number two of the six goals, if I remember correctly, was that there would be an emphasis on eliminating health disparities. I can't remember the exact wording of it, but maybe I could look it up. It, reduction of health disparities, that there would be a minority health research and education program in the school, and so on. So supposedly, you know, when the goals were finished, the planning effort was finished, the dean was going to try to get this to happen. And there actually was an opportunity to try to get, there used to be something called a B budget. So every year the university would get its funding from the General Assembly. That was the A budget. But there was also the opportunity to submit requests for new programs, additional funding. That was called the B budget. And in the last year that a B budget request was actually made, or at least it was thought it could be made, I don't know if it was actually ever submitted, Dot Brown was invited to put together a proposal for funding. This was the year that the Stone Center was being built, and it was thought that we could get space in the Stone Center. So Dot Brown wrote this B budget request, and there were going to be offices in the Stone Center for this minority health research and education project. Well, it didn't actually happen. The B budget thing never happened. I think that was the year that the B budgets stopped happening. But anyway, so it was getting support from the dean's office to do that. I mean, you know, they obviously agreed to do that. Also, there was something in those days called biomedical research support, I think it was, that if you, for the level of NIH money you got, there was a certain percentage that was given to you to do pilot funding, to have small grants and things. So these biomedical support grant, biomedical research support, whatever it was called, the school could allocate this funding. And the dean's office agreed that that funding would now be programmed towards minority health research specifically. And Dot Brown chaired a committee that would put out a solicitation each year, and people would submit, you know, investigating faculty, and if they had a faculty sponsor, doctoral students could submit proposals for pilot funding. With the idea that you would get pilot funding, you would do this project, and then you would go out and get a full NIH grant. So that was going on too. I'd forgotten about that. And Dot Brown was leading this committee that would arrange for the review of the proposals and so on, and also the planning effort for the center, or the program as it later became to be called, because centers require special high-level approvals. And Dot Brown was chairing that committee. And there was a time when I think the dean may have asked Dot Brown if she would actually lead such a program, but then that got dialed back. I'm not really sure what the total story was. So we were kind of on the edge of having a program, but not quite. And Dot's vision was that these three projects, the Quit for Life study, the Minority Cancer Control Research Program, and Project RAP, would be brought into this center, that this program would be created. These would be brought into it, and then immediately you'd have a fully functioning program with projects and people and all that. And it didn't quite get there. And then a little later on in that, this is kind of off the topic of the Minority Health Project, but if you want, I'll pursue it for a little while I remember it. So Michelle Ibrahim finished his term as dean, would have been about 97, I think, or something like that, and Bill Roper came in as dean. And he also wanted to see the minority health research activity as a major focus for the school. And he held a meeting with a lot of the stakeholders, the people who'd been involved, and said, you know, where should we go from here? This doesn't seem to have gone anywhere. What should we do? And it was decided to hold a series of have visits from people outside who could say, I mean, a number of years had gone by, this idea hadn't been revisited, so would this really be something that would be good to do? And while you're visiting us, maybe would you be a good person to be the director? So Bill Roper arranged for these visits by a number of outstanding minority health researchers from around the country. I remember Shriki Kumanyika was one of them. And also, I'm blocking on his name, the man who's now the head of the Duke Medic. Is he vice chancellor for health affairs at Duke? Sorry, I can't remember his name. Maybe we can edit the recording later when I can come up with it. Because he was at San Francisco University of California at San Francisco, I think, at the time, and leading a center. I can't remember. I could probably pull the names up of the other people, but leading researchers came and spoke about what they thought was needed and whether what our center could do and so on. And several of them, at least, were met with the dean's cabinet and maybe were considered to lead this activity. Actually, a year later, when things had kind of gone quiet and we wondered what was going on, Bill Roper had a lunch with faculty, and I asked the question, or somebody asked the question, so what's happened with this minority health research program? And he said, we actually had, we were in active negotiation with, and boy, it's terrible to lose names when you get older. I just had his name, I was talking about him with Bill Jenkins. He was the first head, I think, of the minority health program at the Public Health Service in the 1990s, might have been 1980s, and I'll get his name and we'll put it in the recording maybe, but they were in negotiations and he suffered a sudden death on the golf course up in Bethesda, wherever he was playing. It was a terrible loss. He was a major figure in health disparities work and a wonderful person. So that kind of sandbagged things for a while, apparently. And so it never quite happened. And since that's off the topic of the Minority Health Project, maybe we should come back to this one later on or the next time or whatever. And we could talk about this is what eventually led to ECHO, the program on ethnicity, culture, and health outcomes that the school was involved in for quite a few years. But getting back to the Minority Health Project, so we had this full week institute that the Minority Health Project was leading, and the afternoons were being broadcast on the satellite, and at some point webcasts started being done. So in the very late 1990s, Tim Stevens, I think he was the head of the unit in the school that was involved in distance education. I think it was called the Center for Distance Learning and something or other, can't remember. Anyway, so he helped webcast. We webcast the keynote, or the first day or something like that from the conference. And you know, we would bring in major people to do these talks, and we got quite an audience. In fact, I think at one point, so we were getting pretty good statistics on the people because they all went to these centers. So we'd ask the places that did the satellite to send us an attendance list. So I have attendance lists, or I had them anyway. We had like, 2,000 people, I think, on the biggest. Over the course of, it would like 300 or 400 a day, and over the course of the week it would be like 1,800, maybe even 2,000 people on the biggest. I think it certainly got up to 2,000. I might be exaggerating from those years. We had 140 satellite downlink sites at least one year. I think that may have been the year that Kamara Jones was the keynote. So we were doing this, and then the grants ran out, and so we decided at a certain point that we should make this project free. And the reasoning was partly that without the level of funding, we weren't sure we could do as good a job. And if people were paying, for a while people were paying like $950 to be a downlink site, if people are putting in $950, they're going to be really ticked if this is not at the level of quality that they're expecting. So we thought, well, if we do it for free, that people won't, their expectations will be a little different. They won't be as ticked. And it'll be more realistic for us because we don't really have the same resources. We don't have permanent full-time staff and that sort of thing anymore. So we decided to make them free, and I was very glad I did that because previously we had had like 25 satellite sites. And when it went free and we started promoting it, and that's when I started doing mass emails as well, we got up to, first I think it was 100 sites and then 140 sites. I think we got as far as 180 site registrations for the biggest one, though not all of them successfully could pull the signal down. So this was now, and we also had stopped doing the full day institute, just doing afternoons. So we had 5 afternoons a week doing the broadcasting. And then the next thing that happened was I got a call from someone, a congressional staffer, A.J., well, his name is Aranthan Jones, A.J. is what he goes by, and he had viewed the broadcast from Michigan, I think, where he was a student. He was now a congressional staffer, and he talked to members of the Congressional Minority Caucus about this and persuaded them that they would like to be on one of our broadcasts. So we started working this thing out, and that turns out working with Congress people is a little trickier than working with the people we were used to working with, and I blew some of the arrangements, not going through protocol and stuff, so we didn't get all 4. We originally were going to get 4 representatives, but then one of them bailed out, and then at the last moment, the weekend before, we lost a second one, which was really pretty traumatic, but we ended up with 2. So we had 2 Congress people. They were not from states. They were from the only 2 who stayed on were from territories. So they're not Congress people, but they're congressional representatives. One was from the Donna Christian Christensen from the Virgin Islands, and the other was Madeline. I can look up her name. From the Pacific territory. I'll look that up too. Embarrassed, I can't remember. So, and also, we originally thought they were to come down here because all our speakers came here, but no, that's not how it was going to work. They were going to be in Washington. And so we were going to have to arrange for their signal to come in onto the broadcast, and this was the technology was, you know, nowadays you get into Skype and you're everywhere at the same time and you get video and audio and everything works. When it works pretty well. This was the pre-Skype era, or at least if Skype was around, it wasn't what it is now. So OJ arranged to use ISDN. If you know what that means, I don't remember what it stands for, but it's a kind of telephone line where you get higher data throughput. So he'd arranged for ISDN lines from a recording, from a broadcast studio in the House office building where the congressional representatives gathered. And then that signal came down here, and we had a moderator, and we had 2 panelists here, 4, I think, altogether over the course of the program, and we broadcast this thing, and that was certainly pretty exciting. And then the next year was the year they dedicated the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History. And I had the idea that wouldn't it be exciting if the to actually do a broadcast from the Stone Center, put them on the national map immediately, and also put us on the campus map. So I talked to the director, Joseph Jordan, and he said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And good old OJ, he took it on, even though that was a huge logistics challenge because it had not been designed for broadcasting. He had to work, the Carolina Union had the contract to do whatever it was that was done, their lighting or something like that. And so it turned out to be a huge deal. And of course, a satellite truck had to be brought in and everything, but he pulled it off. And so we had this broadcast from the Stone Center. We had a congressman at that one, too. Congressman Mel Watt agreed to be on the panel. We had the Secretary of Health for Puerto Rico. who was a graduate of the Department of Epidemiology. We had someone from the Asian and Pacific Islander organization, and Gary, should have rehearsed this. Anyway, we had a good cast and a good panel, and so that was very exciting. So I've skipped ahead a little bit, because one thing I omitted is that after I saw what this dissemination could do, the distance projects could do, and the web had become available now for webcasting. I mean, we'd done webcasting of the keynotes on a couple of the broadcasts. I thought, I'd been working with the Minority Health Conference since 1991. That started because when I was applying for this Minority Cancer Control Research Project funding, I thought, well, in the grant proposal, one thing would strengthen it would be to say, we're going to work with the caucus on their annual Minority Health Conference. So we'd been doing that since 1991, and for the first 2 years, I think the Minority Cancer Control Research Program had a day or a half day that was connected to the conference. So the conference was Thursday, and then Friday afternoon we would have a session with the Minority Cancer Control Research Program, or it was Friday morning, I can't remember. But anyway, so I've been working with the conference, and I thought, well, the conference is full. I mean, the conference had moved to the front. In 1991, they were in the School of Public Health in Rosenau Auditorium. 92, I think they were, but they filled it up. They had overflow rooms. So after that, or soon after that, they moved to the Friday Center. But then they started filling the Friday Center up. So they were closing off registration early, and I thought, you know, we could get this thing around the country, at least part of it, by using the web. So we started doing webcasting. I think the first time may have been in 1998. And the Minority Health Project essentially organized the webcast of the keynote. And it was done, it was recorded in the morning, the same plan that's used now. It was recorded in the morning, and then the tape, in those days it was a tape, was driven back to the School of Public Health and the Mays Center. The first one, I think, was done from the Mays Center classroom-style facility. So the tape was broadcast onto webcast. We didn't have money for satellite. And a doctoral student or master student, I can't remember who it was, Renee, the first one was Renee, I think. She was the moderator, and questions came in by phone, telephone, and email. And then the next year, I think it was a similar arrangement. And then it may have been the third year, the state health director provided some money for satellite broadcast. And this was kind of at the last minute, but we sent out a quick mass email, and we got something like 25 satellite downlink sites for the keynote. That might have been the one that Sherman James did. I can't remember for sure. Or maybe he was the following year. And I have some of these recordings, not all of them, but I have some of them now on the web. So at the same time the Minority Health Conference was doing, the Minority Health Project was doing these broadcasts of its annual Summer Public Health Research Video Conference, we were also working with the Minority Health Conference Planning Committee to do webcasts and now satellite broadcast of the keynote from the Minority Health Conference. And those were getting big too. So they were, you know, like well over 100 satellite downlink sites when we finally got up to speed on that. And then the money for the satellite stuff ran out and we just went to web. But by then a lot of people were stopping using satellite anyway and just using the web. So by the mid, like about 2005 or something like that, I think may have been when we stopped the satellite and just did web, and the web was then getting very good coverage. Because early, before that, you know, a lot of places didn't have high-speed internet, so they couldn't really do a classroom thing well. So not sure how much more you want on this. So we've been doing this annual broadcast, so the students took over the Minority Health Conference keynote webcast. At a certain point, they had a committee, and I mean, I worked with them and had a committee, and then they've been doing it since then, and I still work with them a little bit, but not much at all. The Oh, well, then the partner, well, you haven't gotten me into that, so I should hold off on that. So, we did the Stone Center broadcast, going back to the annual Summer Public Health Research video conference, and that put us on the map with the campus. So, for a variety of reasons, one is the school had been providing quite a bit of money and was having to cut back on how much money it could provide for that activity. And our external funding had largely run out. We were getting some from the Centers for Disease Control, partly thanks to Bill Jenkins's assistance. But that was going down. And Barbara Reimer said that she thought that something of this scale, we really needed to find other campus supporters for it. And it also seemed to me that this was a pretty big activity that was putting UNC out there and that other parts of the university would really want to be involved. So I talked with Archie Irvin, who was the director of what is now called Diversity and Inclusion, then was probably called the Office of Minority Affairs, if I remember correctly. That was its first title, and it was originally part of the undergraduate part of the university. And I think it had recently had a broader mandate, and maybe by then they were starting to be called Diversity and Multicultural Affairs. So Archie Irvin and I talked, and Cookie Newsom, who was his associate or deputy director, I can't remember her exact title, but she was like a key person there. And so the following year, she convened a campus-wide planning committee with people that she worked with from several of the schools. I think the person from pharmacy was there. I think we had somebody from, well, Rume Alexander from the School of Nursing was involved. Sandra Thomas from Social Work, and several other people were involved. We had a campus-wide planning committee that put together the next broadcast. And we did another few from the Stone Center, but then they rebuilt the parking lot there. They took away the parking lot when they built the genomics building and the parking deck that's there. So we had to move, and we moved over to the School of Social Work, and we're using their auditorium, and had some very major broadcasts in the summer. We had been using several moderators, professional moderators. So I originally was moderating, and Lloyd Edwards and Trudy Bennett and Dot Brown and I would take turns moderating, and then I was a moderator for a while, and then OJA recruited professional moderators, which tended to work better. We also had doctoral students doing some moderation, and then as we transitioned to cutting down the number of days, because with less money we cut down the number of days, so that we were only doing 1 or 2 days of broadcasting. We would get guest moderators. So for one of the broadcasts, we had Howard Lee, Senator Howard Lee, as the moderator. In fact, he was moderator for 2 broadcasts, and that was very exciting to work with Howard Lee. Very exciting indeed. And the following year, was it the following year? I can't remember the order, but we also worked with the founding director of the North Carolina Office of Minority Health, Barbara Pullen Smith, who was a School Public Health graduate. She was the moderator 1 year. And then we had a program on early childhood that was organized with extensive involvement of the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Center, who had been supporting a number of our broadcasts. But in this one, they not only supported it financially, but they lent us a couple of their researchers to help plan the program and so on. And the moderator was the head of the North Carolina Early Childhood Development Activity. So we had him. And then maybe the following year, we had Cedric Bright, who was the assistant dean for admissions and the head of several programs in the School of Medicine. And that was, I think, the first year. Oh, yeah, so how's your time, by the way? Because
I'm trying to be out of here by like 12:30.
Okay, so we got about 15 more minutes maybe. Okay. I may not get as much to the Minority Student Caucus and Minority Health Conference as you were thinking about, So you can direct me, redirect me if you want, but as long as I'm on a roll with the our health project.
Please keep going. Okay. No, I think this is great.
Okay. So when we had the summer broadcast, these took place in June each year, from the Mays Center in the School of Public Health, there were only 30 people could fit in there, and the audience sometimes got very small. For one thing, you know, a whole lot of students weren't around in the summer, and faculty were tied up with stuff. And we didn't really have publicity resources to get the word out a great deal. We concentrated our publicity nationally, what little we could do, because we were trying to build a remote audience. And we had some involvement from, there were several campus programs. The North Carolina Health Careers Access Program brings usually college juniors to campus for several weeks for a summer program of enrichment activities, biology, chemistry, pre-health, pre-medical kinds of things. So some of their students would come to our broadcast sometimes, part of the week. And there was another one. Sometimes the school had a project going, a program for people in the summer, though that may have started later. But one of the biggest ones was the one in the School of Medicine. The, what was their program called? I don't know, we can edit that into. So it's the project that Cedric Bright runs now, and I, for some reason, can't remember its name. So they had like about 40 or 50 students who would come and spend 4 or so weeks of really intensive instruction in things, pre-medical kinds of things, so that they would be interested and more equipped to handle medical school. And they'd never come to our program, but when Cedric Bright, when we worked this thing out with Cedric Bright, his whole group came, and so they filled up a chunk of the auditorium over at the social, at the, well, okay, so I'm sorry, I jumped too far ahead. All right, so when we were in the Mays Center, we couldn't really accommodate large groups. But when we went to the Stone Center, then we had an auditorium that had a capacity of around 300. So there was the Health Careers Access Program, which had about 40 or 50 students. There was a program, I'm blocking on its name, that was centered on campus, and it used to be run by, I should have reviewed all this information if I could have, but I can edit that in too, maybe. A man who was the associate dean in the graduate school, who had a project for, it was a project for people to come in the summer and do research with a faculty member. I forget what it was called, and then its name was changed later than that, but I could look that up too. So they were a second big group, like 30, 40 students. And then there was a program that the School of Public Health had for a while called Emerging Leaders in Public Health, which lasted several years and then stopped, but I gather it's being revived again. And this brought in people who were already active in their professions, but it was a chance for them to get additional leadership training. It was a project that was developed between the what is now the North Carolina Institute for Public Health, I think they were called that then, and the business school. So they had about 50 people. So the Stone Center Auditorium had a really good crowd, and it was partly, largely due to these three programs that were there. And they continued for a while, except we didn't have the one from the School of Medicine. And then when we when Cedric Bright moderated, he brought them over too. Emerging Leaders in Public Health had ended by then, but we still had three programs in the auditorium and pretty much filling it up. We were actually going into the upstairs balcony using that space as well, and so that was another milestone. And then so I guess that's where, so then the final thing with that, I guess, was that I'm in phased retirement, and we realized that we needed to find some way for me to step out and this project to still continue. So for the last broadcast, the one that took place in September, a committee of people in the school got together. The dean's office provided some support. Their associate dean, Elizabeth French, and Kathy Anderson, the head of, well, she's an associate dean for instructional, for informational and instructional systems. I can't remember exactly what, she's the head of the instructional information systems department, but her title is broader than that. She had a major role in putting that together, and O.J. McGee was centrally involved, and Diane Rowley was heavily involved, and it was thought that Diane was going to be the faculty person who was going to be inheriting this project. But and anyway, so they planned the conference in 2016, and I was involved in the planning of that. And then I stepped back a bit further, but Diane left. She retired from maternal and child health and went down to Atlanta. And so, but the committee continued to put together, the health behavior faculty member who also has left since, that really needs to be edited in. I'm sorry, I'm blocking on her name. See her. Anyway, she had left, but they continued to help with the planning, and they planned the conference. They decided to move it to September because they wanted to have it in the school, and they wanted a good local audience of public health students and faculty. So it was held in the newly renovated auditorium, the Joan Heckler Gillings Auditorium, in September, and there were three speakers. Kamara Jones was the third, I think, and maybe the names of the other two I could edit in also. They were very good ones, a faculty member in media and journalism, and the other was a postdoctoral fellow. And they broadcast from the Joan Heckler Gillings Auditorium. It was very well done. The faculty member whose name I've been blocking on came back as the moderator. Did a splendid... Wisdom Powell was the moderator, and she was a planner. So hopefully that'll be continued now by this planning committee, but they still have to find... I mean, they would like to have faculty involvement, and I'm not sure whom they're going to be able to get involved in it, because it's the kind of thing that is wonderful to work on, but... It's not grants, it's not publications, it doesn't count in the same way as those things, and faculty are under more pressure than ever to bring in funds and to publish in high-profile journals and do the kind of service that that gets them on the national radar. And planning a conference like that, you know, it gets them on the radar in some constituencies, but not necessarily others. So, I should let you ask another question if you want to, because I've...
I mean, you did a great job of kind of tailoring into the next few questions, and you talked about how all those efforts about the Minority Health Project were integrated into Gillings, and then, yeah, the next part was just learning more about the Minority Student Caucus and that Minority Health Conference. But I think this is probably a good place to just stop.
Okay.
Before we get too detailed.
Let me think if there's anything I can reflect on the Minority Health Project before we wind up on it. So it's also had a website. Mm-hmm. Well, when I got involved with the project, one of the things that I was conscious of was how separate the various efforts were on campus. And many schools had something going on, but they weren't really connected. So I tried to use the Minority Health Project as a networking device to link together as many activities in the university as I could, to link them also with other universities and to link them with things in the community, but at least to link them within the university. So I worked closely with the caucus. The caucus had worked with the conference, with the Minority Health Project before that, but I tried to build that linkage more, and I think we successfully did. And we used the website to have We posted every other minority health activity in the university that I could find. I would put them on the website, put a link to their webpage, and so on. We worked with Diversity and Multicultural Affairs. When we sent out a mass mailing publicity about our broadcasts or the Minority Health Conference broadcast, I would also list the School of Medicine's Zollicoffer lecture and the School of Law, which had a conference every year in Black History Month. We'd put their conference listed. When there was another conference we found out about, we would list that too. So the idea was to try to connect all these different parts of the movement, basically, to build a more effective movement. And I think we were somewhat successful in that. It's a challenging thing to do. The Diversity and Multicultural Affairs at the time was not as oriented towards that, but they have become more oriented towards connecting and putting people in touch with each other and so on. But I think we did that to a great extent, and that was a significant accomplishment and contribution from the Minority Health Project. We also, working with the caucus, I mean, we had student volunteers and research assistants who would help put on the broadcast and prepare for it, and we would typically recruit from the caucus, and several of the people who became prominent in the caucus or were prominent in the caucus played roles in our broadcast. Interestingly, the people who were in the broadcast, the panelists and so on, would get national recognition in a way that they maybe would not have gotten as readily. And of course, as we moved on in the years, we then tried to get people who were already known nationally so we could take advantage of that. But one person who became a director of a research center said that she got the invitation partly because she was in one of the broadcasts and people saw her and said, hey, we should reach out to her. So that was a nice story. One of the philosophies that I developed in working with this was the idea that if you're doing a survey and because of non-response, for example, you're underrepresenting a subgroup of your population of interest, when you do the analysis, you give them more weight in the data. So you maybe count their observations as 1.5 times as much or 2 times as much. And so I thought, well, we have this terrible underrepresentation of minorities on faculty, in the students, and so on, in the university, and in the professions, in public health especially, or including. So one of the strategies can be to increase their weight in the overall picture so that you can, to some extent, redress the effect of underrepresentation. And I thought the way to increase their weight is to give them more visibility, give them more support and assistance, and essentially help them to do the things that they think are really important. So when I started in minority health research, I was the PI, and we would be trying to do these things with minority communities that we and our funders thought needed to be done. And I thought, no, that's the wrong model. We should be working to serve the communities and to serve the minority health researchers and professionals who are better attuned to the needs. So when I worked with Dot Brown, Dot was the lead. She was the principal investigator, and I was working to assist her. I then worked with Ada Adamora on several research projects. She was the PI. And with the Minority Health Project and these broadcasts, the idea was we would take leading African-American, American Indian, Latino researchers, give them the platform, and work to disseminate their ideas more widely. So I've used up your time. It's 12:30, and I'll stop here.
Well, great. Well, thank you for talking with us for this second segment, and we look forward to the next one.
Great. Thanks. So next time we can talk about the Minority Student Caucus and the Minority Health Conference. Mm-hmm.